This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last week, there was another in a long series of reports about the use of harsh interrogation techniques on terror suspects in response to a story in the New York Times that the Justice Department secretly endorsed tactics that some regard as torture in 2005. President Bush repeated his assertion that the United States does not practice or condone torture, but argued that aggressive interrogation provides important intelligence and saves American lives. So what exactly are we talking about? What do we actually know about what happens in interrogation rooms? Later in the program, American anthropologists work with the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do social scientists help cultural understanding and reduce violence, or are scholars collecting military intelligence? But first, what are the so-called aggressive interrogation techniques, and do they cross the line to torture? Since 2003, the American Civil Liberties Union has filed requests under the Freedom of Information Act for copies of government memos, studies, and reports on the treatment of detainees in Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, and other U.S. prisons. The organization has received thousands of emails, memos, statements, and transcripts. The ACLU includes several hundred pages of the most important documents in a forthcoming book called Administration of Torture. Amrit Singh is co-author of that book and a staff attorney with the ACLU, and she joins us now from our bureau in New York. And Amrit Singh, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
So what do you know about U.S. interrogation techniques, and how do you know it?
We received several thousand pages of documents relating to the treatment of prisoners held in U.S. custody abroad that shed some light on exactly what interrogation methods were authorized for use in Guantanamo Bay and Iraq, and to some extent in Afghanistan as well. And these documents show that since 2002, senior officials authorized unlawful and immoral interrogation methods to be applied on its so-called war on terror prisoners.
So this is not a question of surmise or your conclusion. These are officials, officers, soldiers saying these in their own words.
That is correct. We have an interrogation directive signed by Secretary Rumsfeld, for example, dated December 2002, that specifically authorizes the use of stress positions, the exploitation of detainee phobias, such as through the use of dogs, and the removal of clothing. Many of these methods were, in fact, depicted in the Abu Ghraib photographs, which the United States government claimed reflected aberrational abuse. Mm-hmm. Well, the documents that we received demonstrate that the abuse was not aberrational, but it was systemic, it was widespread, it was not confined to Abu Ghraib, and it occurred in numerous other locations in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo Bay.
Well, a lot of this seems to go back to a prisoner named Mohammed al-Qahtani, a man who is thought to have knowledge of the September 2001 attacks, and stemmed from interrogations of him that seemed unproductive.
That is correct. The documents do show that in late 2002, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld specifically authorized abusive methods such as forced nudity, stress positions, mm-hmm. And exploitation of phobias, apparently in large part directed towards the application of these methods on al-Qahtani in particular. The documents also show that Secretary Rumsfeld and then Guantanamo Commander Major General Jeffrey Miller were closely involved in the supervision of that interrogation. But I'd just like to point out that the interrogation directive that was issued in late 2002 by Secretary Rumsfeld was phrased generally in as an interrogation directive that applied to Guantanamo prisoners generally. So certainly there was an interrogation plan that was developed specifically for Mohammed al-Qahtani, in which he was stripped naked, paraded in front of female interrogators, made to wear women's underwear on his head, and led around on a leash. But there was a separate directive specifically for mm-hmm. Guantanamo prisoners generally.
Some of those techniques sound demeaning, certainly, humiliating, and psychologically difficult. Nevertheless, is it a matter of interpretation as to whether they add up to torture?
Well, I think that, the question of whether or not this adds up to torture is to some extent an academic question. The fact is that both torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment is unlawful under United States and international law. And in any event, the documents further confirm that prisoners in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan were tortured under any definition of that term. The book that is now being published includes autopsy reports that show that prisoners were asphyxiated to death, that they sustained blunt force injuries, and in fact that the Army itself classified these deaths as homicides. In fact, there is evidence of at least 100 deaths in U.S. custody, 34 of which the Army itself classified as homicides. And so I don't think that there is any dispute here. The documents clearly show that prisoners in U.S. custody were tortured.
Mm-hmm. There are other controversial techniques, the so-called waterboarding. When does that is that introduced, and how often is that used?
We have been trying to get the government to disclose an Office of Legal Counsel memorandum that apparently authorizes the use of waterboarding specifically, but have still not managed to procure the disclosure of that document.
Do you know that technique was used?
We have news reports that say that technique was certainly used, and the recent New York Times article itself mentions also that feigned drowning was among techniques that were specifically authorized by the more recent Justice mm-hmm. Department memorandum. But we don't have any documents that specifically show that technique was used. We're trying to procure the disclosure of that document. It remains the subject of ongoing litigation.
Well, joining us now here in Studio 3A is Jackie Northam, NPR's national security correspondent. Jackie, good of you to come in.
Thank you, Neil.
And here in one volume are 360 documents, and I know you've seen a lot of these before. They've been published on the ACLU's website, and this book is, in fact, a way to pick out, I guess, the cream. Have you learned anything new from rereading these?
Well, actually, I haven't got through all of them quite yet. A lot of them I have seen, and so I didn't focus that much on them. What really struck me, though, was the autopsy reports, as Amrit was just talking about now, because it is in such stark detail. You know, you can have, you know, one side of the administration saying something, you know, human rights people on this side, but these are cold, hard facts written on paper by the military themselves. And as she was saying, you know, there's people that are dying from asphyxiation, from blows, heart failure when they're 27 years old, that type of thing. I mean, it is very, very stark. The other thing about the book as well is it's just, you know, about 4 years on, just when, you know, the Abu Ghraib broke and everything else like that. And it's fascinating to look at this. Again, these are all documents, but what they do is they just put together the puzzle. It just keeps growing and becomes more fixed as we go along. There was a lot of suspicion. There were a lot of accusations, suppositions, and that. Once again, documents say it, and that's what this book is really helpful. Putting a lot of things into perspective.
The administration, just last Friday, President Bush again denied that the United States uses torture. He said we obey national and international law, which would include, the Geneva Conventions. Yet we're beginning to see that there was a lot of argument within the administration and within the military over the use of these techniques.
Oh, there sure has been. There has been right from the get-go. And a lot of these documents point to that as well. But certainly, you know, if you look in the military side of things, the whole idea about torture and these types of military interrogations created enormous concern. You know, we talk to military officials now, and they are so angry with what has happened, how the Pentagon has sort of directed these interrogations to go, because it's a real stain on the military itself. The CIA, you know, a whole different branch, subscribes to a whole different sort of set of rules in this as well. The real problems there, you know, the Office of Legal Counsel, you know, conservative career lawyers have walked out over the arguments about this type of thing. Part of the problem, too, though, is how do you define torture? It's like you said, this is the big thing. Yes, there are many conventions and treaties and constitutional guarantees, and, you know, the U.S., the primary one, of course, is the UN Convention Against Torture. But the thing is, there are no real hard, fast rules. It's like pornography, somebody mm-hmm. told me. You know it when you see it.
Yeah, and Amrit Singh, let me ask you, a lot of these techniques seem to have been derived from practices that the United States developed in its SEER program. That's where they teach, for example, military pilots survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. These are some of the things that you might be inflicted on you if you're captured. If they're willing to use these techniques on military pilots, admittedly for a much shorter time and presumably less intensity than they do with prisoners, how bad can they be?
Well, they can be really bad. That's the short answer to your question. The SEER techniques, when used as a defensive measure, were really designed to train interrogators or train U.S. personnel who mm-hmm. were captured by enemy interrogators to withstand offensive interrogation methods. They were applied in tightly controlled circumstances, and moreover, the personnel submitted willingly to those techniques, knowing that they were not presumably going to die at the end of them. What we see in our documents is the application of SEER methods in a highly unorthodox manner as offensive methods. This is not something that the Army was experienced at doing, but nonetheless, this was a novel application of these methods as offensive tactics. And in fact, we have documents that show that at least one Army interrogator used what is known as close confinement, which he said is a SEER technique, applying that technique, he stuffed an Iraqi prisoner into a sleeping bag and tied the sleeping bag with an electric cord. The prisoner was asphyxiated to death. And when the Army interrogator was reprimanded, he claimed that this was in fact an authorized method and closely matched the close confinement or stress position technique.
We're talking about what we know and don't know about what happens in interrogation rooms and whether those methods amount to torture. We'll talk later with a lawyer who served in the Reagan and first Bush administrations, and we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255. Send us email as well, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about interrogation and torture and when those techniques cross the line, what techniques were used in the wake of 9/11. We're talking about past programs about if and when abuse and torture might be justifiable. That's not our focus today. Instead, we're looking at the so-called aggressive interrogation techniques. Do they cross the line? 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Jackie Northam, who's the National Security Correspondent here at NPR, and Amrit Singh, staff attorney at the ACLU and co-author of the forthcoming book, Administration of Torture. And if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Also joining us is David Rifkin, who served in several legal and policy positions in previous administrations. He'll join us in just a couple of minutes. But I wanted to get back, Amrit Singh. There's one set of documents, for example, that published in this forthcoming book that's called a wish list that indicates that the interrogators did not get permission to use all the techniques that they requested.
Well, I think that the significance of that document is that at numerous points there were directives and solicitations of wish lists of harsh interrogation methods that were circulated across the rank and file of military interrogators. Mm-hmm. And the command climate was one in which interrogators had the impression that anything really goes, that abuse was tolerated as long as it would produce intelligence. And in fact, in the course of applying harsh interrogation methods that they literally, in some cases, conjured up from their knowledge of the movies, these interrogators ended up not extracting actionable or reliable intelligence and abusing prisoners.
Some of these techniques on the wish list included use of, electrical, electrocution, but at low levels, things like that.
That is correct. That was the wish list was submitted in response to an email that went out to military interrogators mm-hmm. soliciting harsh interrogation methods that the interrogators thought they would want to use on prisoners. And sure enough, it was virtually a free for all. Interrogators wrote in and said, close confinement, electrocution, phone book strikes mm-hmm. Were all on the table.
Phone book strikes, in other words, whacking somebody with a phone book.
Exactly.
Open hand strikes, slaps.
Open hand strikes, right.
And closed hand strikes.
Right.
Jackie, as you look at this, what do we know about what has actually been used? What do we know about whether these techniques have been used?
Well, actually, a lot of it comes from documents. A lot of it comes from interrogators who have testified, who have, put forth affidavits, that type of thing. In fact, at the beginning, when Abu Ghraib was starting to break, and you hear a lot of rumors, and then you actually saw, again, these affidavits come through, it was quite shocking. I guess one of the things, too, though, is that, you're talking about strikes across the head or phone books or that sort of thing. I have to wonder, you said it earlier, is this really torture? One thinks of torture as, the Iron Maiden or pulling mm-hmm. fingernails out and that type of thing. And when I started working on this, they were talking about prolonged use of, like, bright lights and loud music and cold and that. And I thought, well, as a teenager, I may have subjected my parents to torture. I don't mean to be facetious, but loud music and that type of thing.
Some of the torture rooms in Saddam Hussein's Kuwait and Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And those...
These were instruments of torture
yes.
in there as well. Exactly. But what I discovered in my reporting is that what happens if, first of all, if you're held captive, then you're already in a vulnerable position as it is right now. You can't leave. You don't know what they're going to do to you. But prolonged use of lights or loud music, it actually creates a sensory overload. And so that way it actually does become torture.
Let's see if we can get a caller in on this conversation. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Bruce is on the line with us from Union City in California.
Yes, hello there. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
That's good. My question is whether there have been any attempts by the government or organizations such as the American Psychological Association or other groups to specifically define what exactly is torture. And this is in addition to what's been done internationally, such as the Geneva Conventions.
Amrit Singh?
I believe that there have been a number of organizations that have come out and said that the certainly methods such as waterboarding and techniques such as stress positions when combined with extreme temperatures do constitute torture. So certainly there is ample support for the position that the methods applied by the Bush administration are torture.
Neil, there's also the argument, though, that...
Jackie Northam, go ahead.
Sorry, there's also the argument, though, that you cannot have a definitive list, a specific, precise list, because once you do that, then everybody can just look down that list and say, nope, it's not there, so I can try and do something else. And so in some ways, it's good to keep it vague as well.
Hmm. All right. Bruce, thanks very much.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Chuck. Chuck's calling from San Francisco.
Yeah, thanks. But the Justice Department or memos about organ failure seem to tell a good part of the story to me. But I was thinking that it'd be very useful to have statistics regarding the number of cases where these techniques are employed, and especially the number of cases that actually yield some kind of useful information. Because so often they're justified as given the ticking time bomb sort of scenario, and that seems like it's probably very rare, and I'm concerned that what's been established is basically a policy that works against our interest because it tarnishes our reputation and undermines our credibility and makes other governments much less likely to want to cooperate with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that conclusion aside, to your point, Amrit Singh, are there any kind of statistics that the government has collected on how often these are used and how often they're productive?
Well, we're still trying to get more information from the government, but I'd like to point out that FBI documents turned over to us through the FOIA litigation demonstrate that at least the FBI was of the view that these harsh interrogation methods did not work. They did not produce actionable or reliable intelligence. And in fact, the FBI comes out very clearly in these documents saying that rapport building techniques are far more effective at producing reliable intelligence. I'd also like to add that the documents also show that, at least in Iraq, the overwhelming majority of prisoners were innocent or of no intelligence value whatsoever. The documents also show that children that appeared to be as young as 8 years old were being held in Abu Ghraib. So the caller is absolutely right. The ticking time bomb is a highly stylized hypothetical that distorts the whole debate. It is not borne out by the documents. The documents clearly show that rapport building was a favored technique by it was favored by seasoned law enforcement officials, and that the prisoners themselves, in large part, at least in Iraq, were not proven terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Yet you talk to officials in Congress and in the administration, and they say, look, one thing we can tell you is that there's not been a subsequent attack on the United States, and that's not an accident.
Well, everyone's waiting for somebody to say something. It seems to me that the way that the folks that did the 9/11 attack like to operate is they're very patient, and they're. I heard someone say the other day they want to top the last one. So I don't think it necessarily means that we can all relax.
That's not what I said, Chuck. But anyway, thanks for the call.
Sorry.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
And Amrit Singh, I wanted to thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Amrit Singh is a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union and co-author of the forthcoming book, Administration of Torture, which publishes hundreds of documents obtained under Freedom of Information Act requests from the United States government. And joining us now here in Studio 3A is David Rivkin. He was a legal and policy advisor for the first Bush and Reagan administrations. He's currently a partner with the law firm Baker and Hostetler here in Washington, D.C. Nice to speak with you again.
Good to have you, Neil.
And when you hear about these techniques and you see these documents, I mean, do you dispute the techniques that are described in this book, that they are used?
No, what I dispute, with all due respect to Amrit and people like her, is the overall picture they draw. Let me just say a couple of things at the outset. First of all, on the question of are these techniques useful, reasonable people can disagree. But to me, the fact that, for example, George Tenet, who was appointed in this position, if you don't like the Bush administration, by mm-hmm. Bill Clinton, who had many problems with the Bush administration.
Former director of Central Intelligence.
Writes with passion and anger in his book, which, again, I always made critical of administration, that this was the single most important intelligence-gathering technique. Because remember, you know, we're not talking about a Soviet Union-type situation. We have defectors. We don't have many defectors. We don't have many agents in place. They communicate in a way that's difficult to intercept. That's the only way. And quite frankly, if his techniques did not yield any results, there would be nothing to debate. Ban them all. Point number one. Point number two, and I'm harking to the question you asked in the first part of the program about the special training. Look,
The
SEER training. Emirate is wrong in one fundamental way. In our constitutional legal tradition, if something is fundamentally wrong, like slavery, like prostitution, like suicide, you can't volunteer for it. And the question of torture and the question, to me,
So what you're saying is those techniques used in the SEER program, if they were torture, you couldn't volunteer
you
for them,
volunteer
and therefore they're not
and
torture.
And you could not volunteer for cult. But you see, torture to me is really off the table, should always be off the table. The question is, what is CID, cruel and human degrading treatment, is very much a function of context. If you ask one of your colleagues to drop down and give you 100 push-ups, that would be totally unacceptable and you'd probably lose your job. A drill surgeon who asks a recruit to stay in a stress position at full gear, parade dress, for hours, or drop down 100 push-ups, or go scrub the bathroom with a toothbrush. He's engaging in conduct that in that context is not considered CID. What I don't understand with all due respect is why the conduct that we can subject our own people to cannot be applied, and the notion that, well, they volunteered for it, or we know they're going to be killed, but here, that is not how it works. And a final point. Again, what I blame critics for is painting everything with broad brush. They're against everything. They got to be for something. I'm uncomfortable waterboarding. I'm uncomfortable with a horribly high temperature. But are we going to take the position that modest variations in the temperature, which, by the way, Neil, do you know something? The interrogator is there in the same room, enduring the same temperature. What the military does, or the CIA does, as I understand it, if they're interrogating somebody for 7 or 8 hours without rest, it's the same interrogator.
Yeah, but they're not talking about 7 or 8 hours. They're talking about 20 hours out of 24 for months at a time.
But what I would like to hear people like Emirates to say, we're against 24 hours, but we can live with 16. But they are for nothing. They're against everything. The position they basically advocate is that all other spheres of life, including, by the way, interrogating people in police stations is no cricket, even in our system. You got people yelling at you, spitting in your face, bad breath, for many hours at a time, threatening that if you don't cooperate, they're going to go after your wife or your kids. That's not cricket. What they are happy to live with that. They're happy with stress techniques used to train our own military. But the only sphere in which they want zero stress techniques is interrogation of all the innocent individuals we captured. That is not rational. That is not a serious public discourse.
We're talking with David Rivkin and with Jackie Northam about the techniques used by U.S. interrogators. Do they add up to torture? You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Rob. Rob's with us from Naples in Florida.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to comment on a few things here that I listened to regarding this alleged torture to extract information out of these terrorists or alleged terrorists. I don't believe that this what they're doing constitutes torture. I mean, a lot of these interrogators use the same techniques in training on U.S. forces. I know this because these techniques were used on me when I went through resistance training back in the mid-'80s.
The so-called SEER training.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've been through a few different phases. I've been through some special forces courses. And, down to the lowest ranking individual, a lot of these techniques are used on our U.S. forces to get them ready for or in preparation for resistance in case they're captured.
Mm-hmm.
So in that aspect, we're training to resist. They're training, and they're trying to sharpen their skills to extract information out of us. Sleep deprivation, putting bags over our heads, stuffing us in boxes, loud music, extreme cold weather, standing around naked, laying on a cement slab in extreme cold weather as they pour cold, ice-cold water over you. Things of that nature. That was, U.S. forces, a lot of us guys were, experienced that in training. I hadn't experienced waterboarding, and maybe some of it does sound a little harsh, but, how else are we supposed to extract valuable information from enemy forces? Do we kill them with kindness? Do we ask them? Do we plead? Do we beg? I mean, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? I feel bad for the folks in Abu Ghraib prison, especially these junior ranking who said it was, they were just following orders. It was systemic. That's the way they were trained. I listened to that, and I absolutely believe them.
Mm-hmm.
I believe them. I think it is systemic. I think that is the way they were trained.
That...
And I think that they were, court-martialed and, put in jail and, had bad conduct discharges based on their training.
Jackie Northam, Rob's point is, I'm sure David was making it earlier, and it is that simply these are harsh. These are meant to be harsh. They're not torture.
Sure, and there is the argument that you don't really want to know what the CIA is doing, but I just wonder if our caller would have been giving up information had he gone through all that if he was being held by, a government other than the U.S. I mean, that's the thing. We don't know. We don't know what Khatani had that he could give up information. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, apparently he confessed to everything under the sun, and that's one of the things that the experts will say is that just stop. I'll tell you whatever you want to know. Just stop. Mm-hmm. So it's two sides of the argument there. So. Mm-hmm.
Very briefly, nature of reliability. Let's stipulate that criminals, terrorists, bad guys are going to lie, whether you extract something with kindness or for stress techniques. What you need to do very patiently, put together the full mosaic where you check and cross-check everything. But just because people are going to lie while you interrogate them is not reason not to interrogate. In fact, if you know that something is a lie, you can frequently learn as much from lying as from telling the truth. The worst-case scenario is they say nothing. And with all due respect to FBI, I can tell you there's a lot of institutional conflict here between different agencies. FBI does not do that. I cannot believe it. FBI seriously believes that they can build the rapport of hardened jihadis. That is utterly improbable when they have hardly anybody who speaks Arabic for right accent, who understand Islamic culture. It's just not plausible. The fact that he can do it with some bank robber doesn't mean he can do it with the likes of KSM.
Rob, thanks very much for the call. Thank Rob, who called us from Florida, and our thanks to our guests as well, David Rifkin, who served in several legal and policy positions in the Reagan and first Bush administrations, and now a partner at the law firm of Baker and Hostetler here in Washington, D.C., kind enough to be with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much
for
your time. And NPR's national security correspondent, Jackie Northam, also with us here in the studio. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you, Neil.
Coming up, embedded anthropologists. Do they help reduce violence in Iraq and Afghanistan, or just serve as social science mercenaries, as some critics contend? We'll talk about that next. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.